Disagreements continue about whether medical use of marijuana is widely effective and could help people suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, I'll talk with marijuana researcher Sue Sisley. She left the University of Arizona in a dispute related to her research. Now she's looking at how cannabis affects veterans with PTSD. Also, what can and should local governments be doing to deal with changing technologies and the potential loss of revenue? We'll discuss drones, parking apps, and more with David Swindell and Kendra Smith. Plus, former Arizona Republic business columnist John Talton has a new book in his Phoenix-based mystery series featuring cold case historian detective David Mapstone. We'll talk about the novel and get Talton's observations on Arizona's economy. And former Arizona Attorney General Grant Woods temporarily put aside writing briefs to instead compose songs. We'll hear a couple of them and find out about his Valley-based collaborators. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first. It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, what should local governments be doing to deal with increased technology and the possibility of lower revenues? Former Arizona Republic columnist John Talton is back with another Phoenix-based mystery featuring historian and detective David Mapstone. Talton will join me in studio. Plus, former Attorney General Grant Woods is used to performing, but usually in a courtroom. We'll talk about his new venture as a songwriter and the Arizona musicians he worked with for a new CD. We start today's program with a look at medical marijuana research with a researcher who generated headlines when the University of Arizona chose not to support her pot-related efforts. That researcher's name is Dr. Sue Sisley, and she joins me now. Dr. Sisley, good morning.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So are some organizations, universities, et cetera, afraid of the research you want to do?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people are just afraid of the word marijuana. It strikes fear. It's just so politically radioactive that a lot of public institutions are nervous about being aligned with this work, even though our study was federally regulated and federally legal with FDA approval and all the other government approvals in place.
Yeah, what did it take to get the FDA approval? How long a process was that?
Well, that was what was a surprise, was the FDA was not the blockade in this process. So we submitted our study design to the FDA back in 2010, and just within 5 or 6 months, we had formal approval from them, and they worked collaboratively with us to help optimize our study design. You know, those are physician investigators who care about seeing whole plant marijuana put through the entire FDA drug development process. So they were not the bottleneck. All these other agencies that don't have any timeline to conduct their reviews, you know, the FDA at least is on a 30-day timetable. But, you know, Public Health Service, National Institute on Drug Abuse, all these other layers of government bureaucracy don't have any timetable.
Did U of A, ASU, and NAU give you real specific straight-up reasons as to why they didn't want to work with you?
No, it's all very vague, and, you know, it's tough because, you know, there were some deep investigations by different media outlets that uncovered that there was some communications between different, you know, Senate president to university officials. But, again, you know, in our case, we're just focused squarely on getting this research implemented, and, you know, we made a very clear mission that this study is an imperative. It's so time sensitive, and all of these layers of government red tape that are impeding this work are really immoral, and it's unconscionable what the government's doing, and not they should be expediting this vital research. You know, the opportunity to collect objective data in this area, especially with the epidemic of veteran suicide that we're seeing in this country. The question is, could marijuana help curb this epidemic of veteran suicide? We don't know, but we would like to finally get some objective data and put this plant through the rigors of a randomized controlled environment.
Well, take us into the initial science of that then. Why does it make sense that marijuana is something that could help folks who have PTSD?
Well, you know, we have some data from phase one studies, you know, from animal studies and also human studies that confirm that, you know, marijuana is the exogenous or external marijuana taken into the human body, it can penetrate the blood-brain barrier and interact with receptors in the brain, CB1 and CB2 receptors that seem to have a calming effect on certain structures in the brain that deal with fear activation, that deal with the retention of memories. So in this case, you know, we want people to be able to lose traumatic memories. And what's happening, you know, those certain parts of the brain are holding on to them and keeping these horrific thoughts swirling in their head all the time. So, yeah, there is plenty of documentation now to show, and that's why the FDA allowed us to enter the process at phase two, because they felt there was enough data from phase one to allow us to move forward. And, you know, if the data from phase two looks favorable, then we will, you know, probably be allowed to proceed to phase three. And after phase three, whole plant marijuana could be on the market. It could have an FDA indication for PTSD, and that would be a tremendous breakthrough, because that would enable, you know, that would cause insurance companies to have to put marijuana on their insurance company formularies. And that's probably why this is so threatening to people, you know, to big, powerful, super wealthy organizations in this country, like big pharmaceutical companies, law enforcement, private prisons. They don't want any objective data that might legitimize whole plant marijuana as medicine. That threatens their business model.
Well, I wonder, what if society, though, as a whole, seems to be moving in a particular direction? At what point will they just have to respond to the general public with that? If the public is starting to support this idea, in certain states, obviously, they has.
Yeah, I think that's what's happened. I mean, that's the only reason our study has finally been greenlighted, is that we, you know, the political pressure, the groundswell of public support for research like ours is so evident. And we've been very fortunate, especially to see the activism from the military veterans community getting behind our study and standing shoulder to shoulder with us as we try to, you know, kick down the doors of the federal government. All these ridiculous, redundant barriers to marijuana research have to be eliminated. And I think the public sees the absurdity of this, the fact that marijuana research is harder to do in this country than heroin research, than MDMA, than any of the other drugs in schedule. It's treated more harshly when it comes to research than any other drug in Schedule One, and it makes no sense to anyone. So fortunately, I think that the public pressure is going to get more and more obvious to elected officials who are participating in the stonewalling of this work.
How important, though, is it that you limit your research to a specific branch of folks? You want to work with veterans who may suffer from PTSD, because those who are opposed to this tend to talk about how they're afraid that it is something that perhaps children can get their hands on. And to many, that's a legitimate concern. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, we're interested in looking at a variety of medical ailments that might benefit from whole plant marijuana. And certainly I'm very worried about preventing pediatric exposures. I think that's a paramount concern for all of us in the medical community and all, you know, anyone who's a parent. But in the end, you know, I think that the regulatory environment has gotten much better at addressing these problems, and we're starting to see the proper packaging and labeling. And ultimately, it boils down to parent responsibility again. It's the same thing we expect of parents to lock up their opioids, you know, their pain pills, their benzos, or anything that could be potentially harmful to kids. They have to do this. They have to treat their marijuana medicine just like any other drug. I would hope that, you know, the research would be able to proceed eventually and give us further, you know, elucidate more characteristics of this plant. We just need to, it's clear that this plant has medical potential. We just need to understand more about how to harness that and what are the details. If marijuana is beneficial for PTSD, for instance, then which strains are best? You know, which phenotypes of marijuana are most optimal for treating PTSD, and which one should be avoided?
Mm-hmm. Marijuana researcher, Dr. Sue Sisley. Dr. Sisley, thanks for taking the time today.
Thank you, sir.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. Rapidly advancing technologies have changed all of our lives, whether it's in what we're watching or listening to or how we pay for groceries. And governments at every level are going to have to figure out how to deal with drones, apps, and even driverless cars. A Brookings Institution report published last month called Local Government 2035, Strategic Trends and Implications of New Technologies, explores the anticipated impact on governance. So where do local governments go from here? With me to talk about that are David Swindell, Director of the Center for Urban Innovation and an Associate Professor in the School of Public Affairs at ASU, and Kendra Smith, a postdoctoral scholar in the ASU College of Public Service and Community Solutions. Welcome to you both. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having us.
Professor Swindell, let's talk about, is government set up to be efficient and nimble in the ways that rapidly changing technology are going to require? Government is not usually known for being nimble.
No, it's not. The technologies are changing at a very rapid pace, and it's outstripping our conversations as citizens to engage in the to engage in how it is that we want to deal with these new technologies as they affect millions of lives of citizens. So we are arguing that the technologies themselves are coming. The question is, how do we as citizens, how do we as local governments work with these technologies in a way that takes advantage of the good sides of them and mitigates against any downsides?
But is government always destined, I guess, to be cynical about this, to always be behind the innovation? And how can government sort of catch up or at least be closer to the curve on that?
Well, that's one of the challenges. And one of the things that we try to do at the center is to facilitate these kinds of discussions, to raise these issues and encourage local leaders to really take into account what's happening in their communities, because their citizens are already engaged in the use of a lot of these technologies. How is it that we're actually trying to foresee the impacts that they're going to have on local government in terms of like their revenues, for instance, and how do we protect our citizens against some of the abuses that some of these technologies could inadvertently lead to?
Kendra, one of the things that's been coming up a lot lately is this consumer to consumer, whether it's Uber or Airbnb, and there are some complications related to that. What should governments need to be looking at when it comes to that?
Well, I think government has a lot to look at. One very big thing that we've seen in this state is the use of Uber and the challenges that the state of Arizona has experienced in regulating Uber and finding really feasible and plausible ways to allow Uber to kind of flourish in our community. And one important thing is understanding the innovation and not being afraid of the innovation, and also being amenable to finding other solutions. That's one big challenge for local government, and I think that they haven't quite gotten there, but I think as new innovations such as consumer-to-consumer or peer-to-peer platforms come into the fore, they will have to.
But we're already seeing things like in San Diego, where, of course, a lot of folks from Phoenix will be going this summer. There are issues where you have these short and long-term rentals. There are concerns about how that's being done. Again, I sort of asked the same question that I asked Professor Swindell, which is, how do you expect government to be able to respond to these things when government is usually behind the curve?
Well, that is the problem. And they're finding that responding, they're always kind of the last people to know about a lot of things. And that puts them in a highly reactive certain situation, really, when they have to react to these things. And so the response and understanding what is coming up, what's new, what's innovative, will be important for a local government, because the reactive position is always the bad position to be in.
Go ahead, David, please.
One of the challenges that local governments face in this, of course, is that they're busy doing the tasks that we, the citizens, have assigned to local government. Mm-hmm. And so finding the time to think, you know, sit back and think about what are these new technologies coming down the pipe, and what are the implications for local government, the way that we are pursuing it in our community, they just don't have a lot of time to do that. And so they are always, not always, but frequently in a reactive position.
Well, if you also think about the process that local government takes to develop a policy, they're busy doing other things, and then policy requires a lot of time, a lot of research. If they're doing it well, it requires those things. And so if you think of any local government that is maybe short on resources, which are those things just take a back seat. And it's not until something happens. There was a story about a lawsuit that a family filed against Uber because there was an accident and a six-year-old child died. no one knows how to handle it, and we're waiting to see the outcome of the lawsuit, because in local governments are the same. They're waiting to see the outcome of the lawsuit to find what precedent will be set in these situations. And so it's just a tough environment for local government.
David Swindell, where's the chicken or the egg on this one? You mentioned perhaps there will be less revenue when it comes to these things. As Kendra mentioned, there's a push to have governments be smaller, local governments in particular, as budgets get smaller. So how are we going to decide as to what comes first, as to what gets fixed first? Is government going to be smaller because there's going to be less revenue, or is smaller government going to lead to some of these technological changes and actually being able to adjust to those technological changes more smoothly?
Well, that's the I would expect the way that it's unfolded in the past will be the map of the future. It'll just happen faster in the kind of iterative process. So, for instance, we see Airbnb, this app that you can use to rent out rooms without having to go to hotels, mm-hmm. is a way of circumventing local hotel taxes. So local governments are going to lose out on the revenues that come from these hotel taxes because people are renting out their own rooms in their own homes to other consumers. And what do you do to get to recoup that lost revenue as a local government who's trying to pay teachers, police officers, etc.? Well, you have two options. One, you can raise your taxes. But the thing about those hotel taxes was those were taxes raised by non-residents. People come into town, rent a hotel, they pay your taxes. That's great. But now then you're going to have to replace that tax loss on your own citizens who may not want those taxes raised, so may stop the local government from doing it. Local government can then only reduce its services. Local government could shrink. So there will be this iterative process where revenues will play a role, but also these technologies will play a role, and local governments will be trying to adapt to this ever-changing environment, but it's just happening at such rapid pace relative to years past.
Kendra, what about expanding use of drones? That's a technology people have heard about more and more. They might go out to the hardware store or something and buy their own drone. What sort of regulations are going to have to come down the pike because of that?
Well, I think a lot of local governments are waiting for the Federal Aviation Administration to come out with their regulations. They've announced that in 2015, they will release regulations on drones. And I think that local governments are waiting to see what they develop before they start to develop. I know that there has been talk about Paradise Valley and the talk about their look into drones and their possible ban on drones, and it's a challenge for them, and they're trying to be leaders in the development of the drone policy, but it's hard and it's difficult because how do you police something that is so pervasive, something that has grown in a short amount of time? You can get a drone for less than $100. You can get a drone that you can operate on your cell phone. How do you police something like that?
David Swindell, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, and Steve, one of the things about these technologies is not that they're necessarily bad or going to have all these bad consequences. Mm-hmm. We want to encourage local governments to see the positives so that they can magnify the positive effects on our communities. And you can take something like driverless cars, which can have an enormously positive impact on communities in terms of safety, in terms of lower costs, in terms of lower emissions, more efficient use of vehicles. Local governments could start thinking well outside the box about what the future of public transit is going to look like, because a local government, instead of investing heavily in a fixed rail, light rail system, could actually invest instead in a driverless car fleet that citizens could then use an app to summon a car as they need it, map a route that's going to satisfy their needs in the most time-efficient manner possible, and lower the emissions that are normally utilized. It makes cars more efficient in terms of the fact that most cars sit idle for 95% of their life. So it makes the fleet a more useful public good that citizens can utilize, and lower issues with regards to driving, for instance. These downsides of cars can be mitigated with this new technology that's emerging. And the question then is, how do local governments capitalize on the good side of these technologies?
And David and Kendra, one last thought before we end the conversation. And David, first to you, it comes to mind to me that maybe I'm being skeptical on this, but it seems that as all these developments happen, we all like to be excited about new technology. It almost feels like the greater efficiency and the loss of of human error, which we see in sports as we see more instant replay used and this kind of thing, changes society so rapidly that it then ends up leading to, yes, more efficiency, but maybe fewer opportunities for humans.
Yeah, that is an issue that's been debated for a good century or two.
Right.
We've faced an increasing development of new technologies over time. And that's one of the challenges. One of the things that we're trying to argue in this report is we need to take the time to have the conversations as to how it is that we're going to integrate these new technologies into our daily lives. One of the issues is that we're just so busy trying to do, what we do every day, what governments do every day, that we don't take the time to do that, which puts us in that reactive mode that we talked about earlier, as opposed to how do we utilize the role for government that we envision for our community in a way that's going to take those good elements, magnify those, and then protect us against any of those downsides that might come along with them. But you're absolutely right. It does. A lot of people have argued that these technologies make citizens nothing more than consumers, that it reduces us to just these individuals who aren't engaged with our communities any longer. We're just there to consume stuff.
Almost passive observers, in a sense, Dave. Almost passive observers is almost how we look at it in the most cynical way, which I don't mean to be totally cynical. Kendra, your final thoughts on that?
Well, to echo David's sentiments, local government, this is almost a crossroads, and this is why we did the report. The report is so important because not that we're fearmongers or we want to talk about all these technologies that will change us forever, but we do want to talk about all these technologies that will change us forever and give local government, whose power and whose authority is legitimate and it's clear right now, and we know the role that local government plays for us, but as technology grows and we become more consumerized, that role will change. And so this is something that everyone needs to pay attention to.
So we'll see if local government can become more nimble. We'll see. Kendra Smith, a postdoctoral scholar in the ASU College of Public Service and Community Solutions. David Swindell, director of the Center for Urban Innovation and an associate professor in the School of Public Affairs at ASU. Thank you to you both.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
And still to come on Here and Now, former Arizona Republic columnist John Talton is back in town with a new mystery. And later this hour, the former Attorney General of Arizona is now a musician. We'll hear some of that music later on. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by the Flagstaff Arts Council, presenting a Navajo rug auction Saturday, June 13th at the Museum of Northern Arizona. A morning preview of 300 weavings and auction at 2 p.m. Details at flagartscouncil.org.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. Stay with us at 1 for BBC News Hour, and at 2, it's the world. Taking a look at some temperatures around the state right now, cloudy sky, 63 degrees in Flagstaff. It's sunny and 74 in Prescott. Mostly sunny, 84 degrees in Casa Grande. It's 86 under sunny skies in Tucson and 83 in Yuma. A special thank you to our Leadership Society members, Mr. Thomas McConnell and Ms. Ilka Williams, for their generous support in bringing programs like Here and Now and All Things Considered to KJZZ. To learn more about the Leadership Society, call 480-774-8444. You can get classic jazz whenever you want it at jazz.kjzz.org. That's jazz.kjzz.org or on your HD radio at 91.5 HD2. With 54% relative humidity, we have partly sunny skies in Phoenix and 85 degrees at 11:29.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. What's a historian detective to do when his business partner looks like the main suspect in the robbery of some diamonds, and that partner is the former Maricopa County Sheriff? Later this hour, we'll talk about the current Maricopa County Sheriff. Nonfiction, not rather than fiction. Because it's fiction and part of John Talton's new novel, High Country Nocturne, we're going to leave some of those questions unanswered. Because the book spends a lot of time in Arizona and because Talton knows this area extremely well, we've invited him on to talk about it and make some other observations about Phoenix. And by the way, he'll be at Poison Pen Bookstore in Scottsdale tonight at 7. Talton is a former business columnist for the Arizona Republic. He now writes about the economy for the Seattle Times and about Arizona and current issues at Rogue columnist com. Now, John, once we've got through the introduction, we have a couple of minutes left for the interview, so thanks for coming in.
Steve, it's great to be back.
Welcome back to your hometown. Let's talk first about the Mapstone book. You've got him in another sort of sticky situation. How has writing these books changed? Because you've written them in three different places now. You wrote them before you moved back to Phoenix. You wrote some in Phoenix. Now you're writing some from Seattle. How does your perception of Phoenix change in the books because of that?
Well, this is the eighth Mapstone, and the very first, Concrete Desert, was written in Cincinnati, kind of as a love letter home, when I thought I would never come back here. And so the first three books were written in other places, and then the next several were written while I was living here, and one critic said that the books got progressively darker as I was writing them from here. But this represents the end of a three-story arc that began with South Phoenix Rules, continued with The Night Detectives, and now ends with The High Country Nocturne. It's not the end of the series, I hope, but it is the end of the story arc. So if you're not familiar with the characters, I would urge you to start with an earlier book. But my perception permanently changed from coming back home after having been away for 22 years. And because I have a condo here, and I don't just come here in the winter, here I am in June, I still am in very close touch with Phoenix.
In the past, we've talked about how Raymond Chandler's books had Los Angeles as a character. And I know when you started these, Phoenix was a character. Do you still feel like Phoenix is a main character in these books?
Absolutely. Phoenix is an essential character. Phoenix is a magical, maddening, deeply historical, whether people realize it or not, crazy, you fall in love with it and it breaks your heart kind of city. And having it as the character in the series is more than ever.
Yeah, I wonder too, John, you're in the process, I know how long you've been in the process of putting together a history of Phoenix. And I don't know if you can talk about that a little bit, but when you think about something like that and how expansive it is part of this actually teaching people that there is a history to Phoenix?
Sure. I mean, David Mapstone is a historian, and he's a native Phoenician, and so everywhere he goes, he sees the history, and I hope it goes down with a spoonful of sugar. I am writing a concise history of Phoenix for the History Press, but I'm also working on a much larger magnus opus that if I can work it in between the mystery novels, may come out someday.
Do you have a certain theory or thesis when you think about Phoenix? I mean, I know we can't really compress that into 1 minute, but your certain philosophies about what makes Phoenix so interesting and so maddening to you?
Well, it is so interesting because it is this utterly unique oasis that there's nothing like it between the middle of the country and the West Coast, where all these rivers come together. It's very well watered. You have this rich alluvial soil. I wrote a rogue columnist post about the agricultural years, and I called it American Eden, and that's what this place was. Phoenix lives with contradictions. It is the place of rugged individualists who come here to reinvent themselves, and yet it's a place that over and over and over again has been rescued by the federal government. And so you go through these contradictions, and Phoenix is one of the most conflicted places with itself that you can find in the country.
When we think about how the role that Phoenix, or more broadly Arizona, plays in High Country Nocturne, your latest novel, is it a villain? Is it an antagonist? Is it more complicated than that?
Well, it is a lover. It is an antagonist. It is a propulsive force. It is the utterly unique setting that drives the plot. And, of course, Phoenix is not the same as the Salt River Valley, is not the same as Metro Phoenix, is not the same as Arizona. So part of the book takes place in the High Country. And I hope I do justice to that, too.
And we have to get this in, John. Valley of the Sun, you're not a fan of the phrase, or at least the valley as opposed to Phoenix. Why is that?
Well, because we're competing in a global economy made up of cities. Whether we want it or not, we're competing against Shanghai and Amsterdam and Seattle and Austin for talent and capital, two things that can go anywhere. And I hate to use the word brand, but we need to have a brand that's not Valley, because then you have to say Silicon Valley, the Valley of the Jolly Ho-Ho-Ho Green Giant. I don't know what that means. When you have one of the most magical city names on earth, Phoenix, use it.
John, I've not seen your check in your savings account, so I will say this without a paycheck. I don't know. Do you prefer writing fiction or nonfiction?
I like both. I had been better at choosing my parents, I probably would have written history and then on the side written fiction.
That's John Talton, author of the new Arizona-based mystery High Country Nocturne. He also writes an economics column for the Seattle Times. And you can read his opinions about Arizona and the rest of the world at roguecolumnist.com. Now joining the conversation for a few minutes is attorney Grady Gammage, who's also a senior fellow with the Morrison Institute. Grady, good morning.
Hey, Steve. Hi, John.
Hey, Grady.
I'm looking forward to the new novel. I can hardly wait.
Well, you're the one who said a great city has to have a great detective, and since this is SmackDown, I was thinking that it's Grady the Assassin Gammage versus John the Undertaker Talton.
Yeah, it sounds cool. Are you wearing a bodysuit?
Yeah.
No one wants to see that, Grady, but thank you for mentioning that. Grady, water use, dealing with the drought, climate change, Arizona gets some points for being better off than California. Do you think that's legitimate?
Yeah, it is legitimate. You know, the governor talked about this yesterday at the East Valley Forum, which incidentally, John, is now using the name Phoenix East Valley. And I agree with you about dropping Valley of the Sun. Phoenix is a fabulous name that we should capitalize on. And even some of the outlying communities are now doing that. We are legitimately, I think, should be recognized for having been planning for the kind of dilemma that the whole West is now facing longer and more seriously than California has, or than most of the West has, frankly. It doesn't mean we should rest on our laurels and feel like there's no issue on the horizon at all. But because we're the junior right holder, because we're a desert city, because this has always been a big challenge here, we are better prepared, I think, than almost anywhere else in the arid West.
I would agree with almost everything my friend Grady says. That we risk getting lumped in with California and some of these other states that have really serious water issues. We have to remember that the Salt River Valley and the Sonoran Desert is one of the most well-watered places in the western United States. And so in addition to some good planning and tons of federal money, we're very blessed that way. Now, how that changes with climate change, we have to find out. But we have to get the story out that Arizona's water issues are very complicated. It's not we're running out of water.
But what happens with California with their claims to the Colorado River, even if Arizona has done better planning? If California can bigfoot Arizona, what are the potential issues there, Greg?
Well, one of the things that we said yesterday, and that actually I was quoted in the paper this morning saying, is we're beginning to pick up signals in sort of commentaries and blogs in California that go something like, hey, Arizona's got all this water they stored underground. They should be using that, and we should get more of their water to use in California now, which is penalizing us for having been prudent and rewarding them for having ignored the issue for a long time. And that's beginning to make us nervous. If you know, as I think all your listeners probably understand by this time, if there's a shortage on the river, we take it first on the CAP. But the first level shortage only hits agriculture. The second level shortage begins to hit cities, and that's when we would plan to use some of the water we've banked underground, or hopefully some of the SRP water may still be available at that point. And so that's why we feel as though we're in a better position. California doesn't have those kinds of things to fall back on.
What California does have is its congressional delegation.
Exactly.
And we go back to the 50s and the 60s and men like Craig Hosmer and Chet Holifield in California, who fought like the Dickens against the CAP. And ironically, or fortuitously, Jack Williams and Ronald Reagan came to an understanding. But Arizona's congressional delegation is going to have to get involved. and really push back, because believe me, California will use its political power.
Yeah, you know, John, another thing I'm beginning to sense is a narrative that goes something like, why are we growing cotton and alfalfa in central Arizona if we don't have enough water to grow vegetables in California? And vegetables should take priority. And this is an interesting argument. We've never had different crops necessarily being prioritized. And maybe we should have. Maybe that's not a bad idea. But I think there's the beginning of an attempt to sort of demonize some of Arizona's agricultural use.
And misunderstand it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Grady, John talked about California a little bit, and I think one of the questions that I'd like to talk with both of you about for just a few minutes, all the time we have left, is sort of this leadership issue, whether that comes from elected officials or not, or what the expectations are. John, you've often been cynical about where the leadership comes, in part because we don't have headquarters here, et cetera.
A little skeptical.
A little skeptical, okay. And Grady, what are your thoughts on that? There's always the next generation of folks that we think are going to be the leaders. Are they actually here?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of problems. One is the business problem John points out. A second problem is that since the CAP got built and funded, we sort of eased up on worrying about this for the last 30 years or so. And the people who were the water buffaloes, the water leaders of that era, have disappeared. And there really aren't any water speakers. It's like Esperanto, you know, in the legislature at the moment. The new Kyle Center that we started at ASU is actually trying to start a program to educate elected officials about water issues in Arizona and how to talk about water issues in Arizona. John pointed out earlier, we need a much more sophisticated understanding of what Arizona's water situation is. And that's a level of sophistication that is largely missing in a lot of elected officials in Arizona.
This is the first time that we do not have a water senator. For years and years, we had Carl Hayden. For decades, he was the workhorse. Barry Goldwater was the show horse. And Ernest McFarland was a water senator. And then we had John Kyle as our water senator. He was the workhorse. McCain was the show horse. I don't know if Jeff Flake will evolve into that, but in the Senate, we've got to have what has always been the Arizona water senator.
Yeah, I will say, John, I think Senator Flake is trying. He knows this. I mean, he's aware that there is sort of a gap there. And I've seen him in two recent water forums actually listening to people, which is kind of amazing for a senator to start with. And he wants to step up, I think. Not there yet, probably, but wants to be there.
John, final thoughts?
I think that we have the elephant in the room, and that is sprawl. We cannot keep sprawling under the conditions that we're facing. In my ideal world, we would pull back into the footprint of the Salt River Project, but certainly not keep expanding. And this is probably where Grady's head will explode.
Grady, about 30 seconds.
Yeah, he's wrong. I'll plug a book I'm working on for Island Press that is about whether or not Phoenix is sustainable. And, you know, we are not the poster child for sprawl. People think we are. I think we will continue to grow on the edge even as we become more dense in the center part of the city. Clearly, we're not going to pull back to the SRP boundaries. And I don't think we need to. I think we can continue to grow in the pattern we have, but I do think we're going to grow more slowly, and I think that's a good thing. And I think we're going to grow in a more diversified economic way than just subdivisions and trying to lure people here from the Midwest.
Well, a lot of people
the promise of a cheap house.
A lot of people would say it's about time. Grady Gamage, attorney, also a senior fellow with the Morrison Institute. Grady, thank you as always.
Sure. Glad to talk to you.
And John Talton, author of the new Arizona-based mystery High Country Nocturne. You can also find him writing columns for the Seattle Times and read his opinions about Arizona and the rest of the world at roguecolumnist.com. You can see him tonight at 7 as well with his new book at Poison Pen in Scottsdale. John, thanks as always.
Thanks, Steve.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk to E.J. Montini about Sheriff Joe Arpaio and former Attorney General Grant Woods turns musician. Stay tuned. You are listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. On Tuesday, Sheriff Joe Arpaio officially became the longest-serving sheriff in Maricopa County history. Arpaio took office in 1993. His longevity was marked by a celebration with some of the sheriff's friends and employees. Arpaio said it was an emotional day for him, less than a week before he turns 83 years old.
I'm not here to make history, but it just came that way. And like I say, it's very humble to have been the sheriff.
Arizona Republic columnist E.J. Montini has covered the sheriff closely throughout his time in office and wrote a column earlier this week saying now would be a great time for the sheriff to call it quits. And E.J. Montini joins me now. E.J., good morning.
Good morning. How's it going?
Good. So on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being metaphysical certitude, what is the chance Joe Arpaio resigns or retires this year?
I'd say it'd be zero. I just don't see. I mean, you know, he's one of those great. There's an element to him that I honestly greatly admire, which is he reminds me of one of those professional athletes. And people say, you know, he's losing a step here, he's losing a step there. He should consider quitting, right?
Right.
When I'm one of the people who says no, you know, if I'm a professional athlete and I can still play and my team still wants me, you're going to have to drag me kicking and screaming off the field. He's that guy. He's, you know, he still feels like he can play. Still feels like he can be in the game. And I wouldn't, you know, and it's what he really, really, really likes to do. And so, you know, he's in this big trouble in federal court in front of Judge Snow, and we'll see how that turns out. But I don't see him walking away.
Well, so is there something to this that you believe all the years you've talked to him that he legitimately thinks he's making a difference, or he is more of he just really likes the attention?
I don't think he does really, really like the attention. There's no doubt about that. But I also think he just likes it. I think it's just he has fun pretty much every day. And he figured out a job. He walked into a job that I don't think he expected it to be the way he is. I tell people sometimes he reminds me, you know, if he were a painter, he'd be like Grandma Moses. He would be what art critics would call a naive genius, you know, somebody with no training, but who is just sort of like inherently able to do this stuff. Like a lot of the things he's done in the jail that are just silly, like the pink underwear and the chain gangs and the tents and everything, which plays tremendously well from a public relations point of view. Does really nothing, you know, in terms of law enforcement, but it works really, really great with the public. He's just got a natural, you know, ability to pull that kind of stuff off. On the really downside, you know, there have been tremendous problems in his jails, and too many people have died in them, and there have been too many lawsuits, and county taxpayers have been, you know, too much behind the eight ball because of that. But, you know, we keep voting for him.
Yeah. Do you ever question, even with the clear mistakes he's made over the years, and major ones in some cases, you know, costing people their lives?
Yes.
Do you ever question his sincerity or his motives?
I do not. There are a number of the sheriff's critics who think of him, who really want to portray him as evil. I do not believe that. He is not an evil man. He makes a lot of mistakes, but I think is generally, you know, his heart is in the right place. He's wrong-headed too often, and you know, but at the same time, you know, he's not he's conniving enough to want to maintain his position, and he'll do what he has to do as far as that goes from a political point of view. But I don't see him as evil.
EJ, one last question for you. Was there ever a time, because again, he's such a caricature now, was there ever a time he was actually an effective law enforcement official? I mean, was it a good, when he was elected the first time and told a lot of people he was going to serve one term, was it a good idea at the time, considering all the stuff that had gone on with the Wat Phram Kunaram temple, et cetera?
That's exactly right, yeah. Well, it might have been. And I think actually the sheriff, you know, where he turned for me more than anything, some of the goofy stuff was okay with me, but there was a point, if you look it up a few years back, there was a former National Guard person named Patrick Habb, who was arrested because he was holding hostage on the side of the freeway what he believed to be a group of illegal immigrants who he ran into at a rest stop, right? When that first occurred, the sheriff went there and immediately arrested Patrick Habb for holding a gun on people who had committed no crime. Well, the public was vehemently in favor of Patrick Habb. You know, at that time, we were very much an anti-immigration community. And the public was very supportive of this guy, and overnight, the sheriff switched his point of view. totally going along with the community on that one. And that to me is where the worm turned on him, because then he knew what was the right thing to do, and he did the political thing, and that was the end of it for me.
Arizona Republic columnist E.J. Montini. You can read him on Thursdays, Fridays, and Sundays in the paper, and then online probably at all hours. E.J., thanks for the time.
All hours. Thank you very much.
Take care. You are listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. It's said of a lot of lawyers and politicians that there's more than a bit of performer in them, but not many do that performing outside of a courtroom or without a podium in front of them. Former Arizona Attorney General Grant Woods, who's now in private practice, took his love of performing and music to writing songs, which has led to a new album titled The Project. It includes musicians closely associated with Arizona. Grant Woods joins me in studio. Good morning, Grant.
How you doing?
Good. So at what point did the songwriting become a reality for you when you decided, I really want to put my mind to this?
Well, I've been into, I've been doing a lot of writing, I guess, over the last 10 years or so, but songwriters and songwriting has been an important part of my life, you know, since the college in the 70s, when singer-songwriters were kind of at their forefront. As far as me actually doing it myself, that was really more in the last 10 years or so when I started getting into that and trying to do it on my own. And it just kind of took off and turned into this project. I think the reason is because we decided just to do an all Arizona effort to try to do a couple things. One, put a positive light on Arizona from some of the people you were just discussing who, like the sheriff, who give us a negative image, I think, around the country. That's really not our reality. We're not a bunch of bigots or racist. It's a very open community, I think. We wouldn't live here if it was like that redneck image. So we just took a lot of the artists and musicians who have continued on a great legacy of great music from Arizona, and we kind of put all this together, and it's been very exciting. And we're doing it to benefit the arts in Arizona, and in particular the Arizona School for the Arts.
Have you considered yourself to be a good writer in other aspects of your life, whether it was legal writing, fiction writing, et cetera?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's been, that was my big dilemma coming out of college. Was I going to go to law school or try to make it as a writer? And I took the easy way out and went to law school, and I kind of had it in my head I would try to do both. And that's, you know, that proved difficult until, you know, the last few years, where I'm trying to focus a lot on writing now, just because I love it, and I've done the other things. I like practicing law, and the clients I represent, I can really get excited and go full speed behind them. Mm-hmm. Politics, I'm less and less interested in. It's become more and more dysfunctional. And I think for me, it's more fun, more interesting, and maybe ultimately more impactful to deal in the arts rather than in government.
Well, is it more fulfilling for you as a human being in the sense that, I mean, you've been so actively involved. People know you as AG. They know you involved in all sorts of campaigns, yeah. Saw you in commercials in the last campaign. But there is that feeling that in order to be good at politics and to be good at the law, frankly, mm-hmm. you've got to get down and dirty at times. Mm-hmm. And so you're probably at the end of the day thinking, glad that I did a lot of those things, but I also maybe feel like I need to take a shower. When
exactly.
you're in the arts, maybe not so much.
No, that's exactly right. It's my experience dealing with, look at these artists, the Francine Reeds and Nils Lofgren and Scotty Johnson from the Gin Blossoms and Blaine Long, Michael Nitro, all these people that put their heart and soul into this record. I would just tell you, it was 100% positive.
Yeah.
We were all pulling for each other. We're all trying to do something creative and to do something positive, as opposed to litigation, which is very negative, or politics, which is the worst.
Let's hear from Lawrence Zubia, who from Pistoleros, who's the lead singer on one of your tracks. Let's hear a little bit of that.
In Sayurita on a sunny day, surfers line up to catch a wave. People sell you what you need to eat. Kids just roam the streets. No one cares where you come from.
Boy, and that hearing that voice,
yeah.
people who've lived here for a long time. In fact, we had the Pistoleros in not long ago here in the studio talk about various things. And so you deal with someone like that, when you hear your words with that voice, what does that feel like?
That's exciting, you know. I wish I was in the car now. I get heard on the radio. One of the stations played that song yesterday morning on the radio, and I did happen to catch it. And, yeah, that's fantastic. Lawrence Zubia and his brother are just... And they're good examples of some of the great music that's come out of Arizona. And that's another thing we want to do, is show the world that, you know, the arts are alive in Arizona, they're important in Arizona, and we have a rich tradition of music here. Look at all the great people that have come out of here, and the music that's still coming out of Arizona. And yeah, I love Lawrence's voice. He killed it on that song.
I think a lot of people are excited, too, that you really, it's not just that you used musicians from here, you used musicians that... You know, I mean, yes, hit it big in a sense, but not hit it on the huge national stage. And I think that's exciting, too, for people.
It is. They all ought to be, I'm serious about this, they all have just amazing talents. And they've all had great success in their lives in one way or the other. But they're, other than Nils Lofgren, who, you know, with the E Street Band and Crazy Horse and Ringo Starr, I mean, he's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Other than Nils, I would say they haven't achieved, you know, national or worldwide fame. So if we could shine a little light on them, that's great. That's exciting. Yeah, that's one of the things I hope we get out of this as well.
And since you mentioned Nils Lofgren and Francine Reed earlier, let's hear a little bit of that song.
She closed her eyes and tried to pray, but never knew just what to say. Did she do those things she did and have those secret thoughts she hid? Please help me, God, to get these doubts out of my head.
That song, Even Jesus Wept,
Even Jesus Wept, and, you know, Nils does the second verse there, and then they finish up together, and also Nils plays guitar on that, which is very exciting as well. And you know, as to performing, which you mentioned, there's I really have no interest in that. I just don't. I guess I could do it. I don't know how great it would be, but it certainly wouldn't. Why would I want to do that? Why would I want to play? They asked me that. Nils in particular wanted me to play guitar on that track, just because, you know, for fun. And I thought, are you serious? Why? I mean, with Al Ortiz, you know, Stevie Nicks bass player, and Nils and Scotty Johnson, I'm going to play the guitar? That makes no sense. Or sing with Francine Reed? I don't think so.
Well, right. It sounds like, I mean, you made a legitimate album here, and you're dealing with musicians, and you wrote the songs, which in a lot of ways, it doesn't sound like a vanity project, because you let great musicians play their music.
Yeah, I didn't even want my, it's called Grant Woods the Project, only because it had to have something on there, and believe me, I fought that all the way. I didn't want to do that either. It's a thrill for me to have these people sing and play my songs. That's fantastic.
Yeah, Grant, final thought. Was it because, I mean, again, for those of us in this circle who are political junkies, you're very well known.
Yeah.
Did these folks all know who you were when you folks called?
No, not necessarily. A couple, but kind of where it took off, Michael Nitro came in the middle of the night, apparently. I wasn't around. Like 1 a.m. or something, and sang right out the storm. And he said, hey, I want to know who wrote this. I want to be in his band. And then later they told him that I wanted to meet him, and he thought he'd done something wrong, I guess, you know, so he was afraid. No, they didn't. Most of them probably didn't know who I was, and if they did, they didn't care, and that's how I like it.
Former Attorney General Grant Woods, his new CD with songs written by him and performed by some of the great Arizona musicians is called The Project. Grant, thanks for coming in.
All right. Thanks for having me.
And thanks very much to senior producer Sarah Ventry and Bruce Drummond for their help on today's program. Thank you very much for listening. If you missed any part of the program or want to hear one of our previous segments, go online later this afternoon to KJZZ.org or download the KJZZ app to your smartphone. I'm Steve Goldstein. NPR's Here and Now is next on member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. Hope you have a great day. It's 12 o'clock.
KJZZ is supported by Mesa Art Center and Grammy Award-winning singer and composer Esperanza Spalding. An evening of musical vignettes incorporating theater, poetry, and movement. Saturday, August 15th at 8 p.m. Tickets at MesaArtCenter.com.